Good morning. It is a real pleasure to be able to share this morning. When Elaine asked me to do it, I was actually really unexpectedly delighted to find that it just so happened that what she was asking me to speak on is a passage that I have spent a lot of time thinking about and working on. So I'm really happy that I can and share some of those thoughts. And one half I've spent a lot of time thinking about, another half not so much. So there's been things that I've been thinking about and things that I've been looking at anew. And so I'm looking forward to sharing those this morning. And through these two passages this morning, I want to bring us to a place of thinking about what it means to shine as followers of Jesus and what it means to keep our eyes focused on the perfection of the kingdom rather than on the bare minimum of what is required to obey the law. So I'm just going to read quickly. You'll see in your sermons that there's actually, I think it says Matthew 5, 17 to 20. I didn't actually prepare that, and I'm glad because there's so much in what I had that even as I was sitting there, I was thinking about, oh, I could have said more about that or about that. But I'm going to trust the Spirit this morning that he will speak to you, and what I have prepared will bring what needs to be brought. So Matthew 5, 27 to 32. You have heard that it was said, and this is Jesus speaking, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of unchastity causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, I love the Sermon on the Mount because it lays out so much that is vital and valuable for how to live together as followers of Jesus and what it means to live together with other people, not just as Christians, but for everyone. If we could all take these words and believe them and live by them, I believe that the world would be radically changed. In one sense, the Sermon on the Mount is so ambitious that we could never live by these words completely. And that is the fact that it is Jesus who is speaking them that means so much. I believe that Elaine mentioned this last week, but I will say it again. Although the people listening when Jesus spoke these words didn't know it at the time, we know that Jesus would go on to show them the full extent of God's love for all of humanity. Being the Son of God, he became human and showed us compassion and love and submitted to a cruel execution in order that he could come back to life and make a way for all of us to do the same. The Sermon on the Mount lays out the ideal for life together, an ideal that truly seems impossible to hope for, and yet in the life that Jesus led, he showed us that even if we cannot hope to attain this ideal life together on earth, there is hope in Jesus that he will bridge the gap for us. The Sermon on the Mount is an incredible guide that shows us how to live well and justly and with love. It shows us how to live a life that reflects and shines out the love that Jesus showed to us, even in the midst of the many, many challenges we face in this world. So before we dig into the particular text we'll be looking at this morning, I just want to take a minute to share with you two foundational elements that, for me, inform everything else in the sermon that follows. Elaine has touched on these a bit already, but since this is my 1 week, I just want to frame the terms. So Jesus begins with a blessing. It says in Matthew at the beginning of this passage that Jesus was teaching his disciples. So what he was saying was not necessarily addressed to everyone who was there. It was directed to his disciples, but it was spoken in the open so that anyone and everyone who might be there could listen. And it sounds like there was quite a crowd there. So Jesus begins by explaining to his disciples, the ones who have left everything to follow him, to learn from him, that he is bringing a blessing that is for all people. even the ones who at that time might not have been considered to be worthy of the blessing. And what is beautiful about the setup is that as he says that, everyone can hear this. Many of those in the crowd who were there listening would be the very people who might have been surprised to hear that God's kingdom was for them too. I'll just read it quickly again. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Blessed, 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 blessed. Jesus is bringing a blessing. And it's a blessing that can coexist with suffering. Even when they are persecuted for following Jesus, they are told, "You are blessed." So this blessing is not necessarily a blessing of wealth, health, and success. It is something more. And it is for everyone. So this is the first bit of knowledge that I think is really important to hold on to as you consider everything else in the sermon. And the next is this. Jesus tells his disciples that they are the light of the world and that they are the salt of the earth. He tells them that they are the ones who shine light into the world and who bring it flavor. I think it is important to remember that he tells them this before he goes on to talk about righteousness. Elaine spoke last week about how much of the Sermon on the Mount is about righteousness, about how to live well, how to do what is right. And before Jesus explains all these things that he is about to explain to them, he makes sure that they know that they are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. He doesn't say that they are the light of the world and the salt of the earth if they do everything that he tells them to do. No, they already are the light of the world and the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Full stop. You are the salt of the earth, full stop. But even if it isn't conditional, he does let them know that it is possible to cover the light. It is possible to lose that saltiness. The light they shine and the saltiness that they bring is not dependent on what they do. God gives it to them, it's there. But there are things they can do to get in the way. And so he doesn't say it explicitly, but I like to think of it this way. When we choose to follow Jesus, when we choose to be his disciple, we are the light of the world. And that is not because of anything that we do, other than choosing and following. It is because of the light of God that shines through us, because of God's Spirit that is within us. We are transformed by God's light within us, but at the same time, it is possible for us to do things that block that light. We can do things that get between that light and the people who need it. We are the light, but it is also possible to block that light. I like to think of everything that follows in the Sermon on the Mount as an outline of some of the main ways that we can block that light and how we can avoid blocking it. So following the things that Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount is not necessarily how we shine our light, but it is how we can enable that light that we have to shine through more freely. So let's start with this morning's passage. Jesus begins, as he has, with the law that his disciples would know. "You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." The laws in the Old Testament on adultery are pretty clear. There's not just one passing reference to adultery. It was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. The penalty in the Old Testament for committing adultery, as outlined in the Old Testament, is death for both the man and the woman. Doing a bit of reading, it's unclear how often this was actually enforced. It's possible that the practice of the death penalty for adultery was not common, but regardless of how the law was followed, it's clear what the law says. It is wrong and it is serious. So what is adultery? I'm sure you probably know. I'll just go over it quickly. Adultery is sexual intercourse with someone who is married. But looking at context, in the Old Testament, the focus is generally on sexual intercourse with a married woman, another man's wife. I think there are a couple of reasons for this. First of all, in general, it isn't prohibited in the Old Testament law for a married man to have sexual intercourse with another woman so long as she isn't married. There is acceptance of polygamy for a man. There is provision for a man to have a concubine or for him to have sex with a female slave. And the reason I'm raising this is I'm not saying this shows support for this kind of thing, but I think it's important to give a little insight into that time. Reading various commentaries online, it seems that we can look at the law as being a product of the time, in the sense that it was a reflection of life as it was. And under this view, the law talked about polygamy, not because it intended to condone it and to make a provision for it. It talked about polygamy because it was something that was practiced. It was part of their world. And so it made sense for it to be part of the world. It isn't as if there was no polygamy prior to God giving Moses the law. It was a part of their world, and so the law addressed it. The law is addressing a reality of the time, and in doing so, it is trying to regulate and to protect. You might wonder why the law didn't flat out forbid polygamy at this time. I don't know, but perhaps it was more important to flat out forbid murdery and stealing first before working up to polygamy. I think it's also important to note that if the law seems to skew more towards men, it seems more patriarchal and doesn't accord women sometimes the same rights, that's because it was a reflection of the time. But it was also, these regulations were there to protect against that reality, to try and provide some justice. And so that was for that time. So the law was written at a time when it was dealing with the issues of the day and also with the context of the day. The law is trying to achieve something that makes sense for that time, but it is also based on principles and ideals that will still apply in the future, even if the issues of the day and the cultural context will change. There is a truth and a justice to God that is underneath it all, and that truth and that justice is shining through and speaking to that people, and that justice and that truth doesn't change, but how that is expressed to the people it is spoken to may adjust. Someone who talked a lot about the law in the New Testament was Paul. He was trained as a lawyer, and he knew the law of Moses as well as anybody, I think. I also think that he really loved the law. But at the same time, and I'm talking about the Mosaic Law, what's in the Genesis through Deuteronomy, the Old Testament. But he loved that law. But at the same time, and especially after he became a Christian, after he got to know Jesus, he saw the limitations of the law. He knew that it was limited. He knew that the law couldn't make you good. The law couldn't make up for wrongs already done. The law is a guideline with penalties that tries to keep order, to protect and to make provision for justice. The law can show us what is wrong. It can show us what sin looks like. But it's not as successful as showing us what real active goodness looks like. It doesn't necessarily have a lot to say about love. It doesn't necessarily speak to what it means to shine. And so Jesus is speaking to the bare bones minimum baseline of the law and says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you, that everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And just to state the obvious here, Jesus is speaking to men. It's possible that a woman would be looking at another woman with lust, and this would, of course, be applied to that. But given the society at the time and even our current culture, this is something that is addressed to men primarily. In the same way that in the law, adultery refers to having sex with another man's wife. And I'm not saying that this only applies to men. I just want to... Jesus is speaking to men, and there are reasons for that. I've alluded to it already, but this was a man's world. Women don't have a lot of power at this time. They don't have a lot of agency. I'm not an expert on this period, but I know enough to say that a woman would be expected to be married so that the husband could provide for her material needs, while she does everything else. She wouldn't have many rights, but would hope that her husband was a good man who would treat her well, because if he wasn't, there was not a lot that she could do about that. And one of the main things that a woman would be expected to do would be to bear children for the family, and hopefully she would bear a son. The laws on adultery would be intended to protect this. And I would also hope that people didn't like their husbands or their wives to have sex with other people. This is something that hasn't changed over time. And so the law was certainly to protect that as well. But I think that due to the woman being the only one who was able to bear children, this resulted in the laws of adultery. It resulted in the time being more permissive to the male side. And as crude as it sounds, if women are only allowed to have sex with one man, there's no doubt about who the father is. So it was a man's world, and the law reflects this. And Jesus is speaking into this. So I would guess that this was why it was tolerated in the law for a man to have more than one wife and to have a concubine. Not fair, but as I said before, it was a man's world. So when Jesus tells them that if they look at a woman with lust, he is addressing this situation where a man has accepted that adultery is wrong and proudly abstains from it in any form, but presumably feels free to look at women and think about them with desire in his heart, knowing that it is something hidden in his mind where no one else can see it. When a man does this, he thinks nothing of it. Sometimes, anyway, he knows that the law forbids him from actually having sex with another man's wife, but the law says nothing about imagining it or thinking about it. He knows that he is not to covet his neighbor's wife, but maybe that applies if he only plans to commit adultery with her, or perhaps he feels free to covet the wife of a man who is not his next-door neighbor. Whatever the case may be, Jesus is speaking to the case of looking at a woman with lust, and what he tells them is that doing this thing is exactly the same as committing adultery. He tells them that by looking at a woman with lust, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So let me take a second here to define what I think that lust is. Jesus doesn't tell his listeners not to look at women at all. He's talking about looking at women with lust in the heart, but looking with intent. And this is something that is not limited to men. This is universal. There is a difference between seeing someone or something beautiful and realizing that this beauty affects you. As humans, we can respond to each other by sight. It is possible for the sight of another person to cause a response inside of us, to make the heart flutter, or whatever that might be. Beauty affects us. I don't think that Jesus is talking about this. But there is another way to look at another human when the response is sexual in nature. It can be quite a pleasurable sensation sometimes to see a person and to have a sexual response. It's quite natural. And this the way that we work this way as humans plays a part in how we come together in relationship, when in a marriage relationship, that kind of thing. So I want to be clear that this is a very natural reaction in humans. It's not a bad thing. But Jesus is raising the very real possibility that this very natural reaction can become a problem. It can become a negative thing. When there is something in the way that a person looks when we see them that stirs sexual desire, there's a moment where a person can see it and can grasp onto it. They can let it linger. They can savor it. And this is where the line sort of crosses into lust. We can abuse this very natural human reaction. We can turn it, something that is beautiful, into something that is cynical and exploitative. I will explore this a little bit more, but I just want to keep going with the text. So Jesus has established that looking at a woman with lust is the same as committing adultery with her in your heart. And he goes on to say this: if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell. I just want to take an aside here to say that sometimes the idea of hell can be troubling. I get that. We may have heard descriptions of hell that are troubling in our lives. We may have been taught things that are troubling. I don't have time to talk about that now. It's not in the scope of this sermon, of course. But I do want to say this. We're familiar with the idea of death. Everybody dies. This was the penalty we learn about in the very beginning of the Bible. And this is one of the reasons that Jesus came, to save us from death. Jesus came to offer the possibility of eternal life and escape from death. So death, in a way, is an eternal punishment. And if the way it has been described and taught is troubling to you, and if it even makes you question sometimes the love and the justice of God, then I want to urge you here just to set that aside for now. The certainty of God's love and his justice is beyond question, and I would urge you to hold on to that. That is far more important, especially for what I'm saying, than the theology of hell. There's a time to talk about those things, but for today, when Jesus talks about hell, it is enough to know that he is talking about an end, the crossing of a boundary where the gift of eternal life is not taken. It's very serious. When he talks about hell, it is serious. So, but back to the cutting out of hands and the gouging out of eyes. When I hear that, when I hear Jesus talking about cutting off the hand, gouging out the eye, it sounds crazy. And I think to myself, I think, Jesus can't actually be telling us to cut off parts of our body because of lust. Because sometimes it feels like, is he actually doing that? It's so striking the way he says it. So first of all, let's look at this idea of cutting off a part of the body in order to save the rest of the body. This is actually not a crazy idea. This is a very practical idea. It happens in real life. I'm reminded of one of my favorite Westerns when I was a young man. It's called Lonesome Dove, Robert Duvall, Tommy Lee Jones, Angelica Hughes. It was such a good... Anyway, there's a scene in that Western where one of the heroes, an old Texas Ranger, he has been out in somewhere in the Midwest and he's got an arrow through the knee. He has to get away. He has to cross through a river. Anyway, by the time he gets medical attention, the wound is infected. And there's a scene where he wakes up and he's sitting there and the doctor has amputated one of his legs. And the doctor is preparing to amputate his other leg. And if he doesn't amputate the leg, he will surely die because of the gangrene, because of the infection. And so he's faced with the question, the dilemma, do I become a man with no legs or do I die? The only way to save him is to cut off that other leg. So this is actually not a crazy thing. If we are in grave danger, if our whole body is in grave danger and cutting off a hand or an eye could save us, then wouldn't we do that? It's serious. Jesus is saying that lust is a big deal. Adultery is a big deal. And when we look at someone with adultery in the heart, we are in great danger. So here's why Jesus is talking about cutting off hands and gouging out eyes. There is a way of following the law that focuses on doing the bare minimum in order to fulfill the letter of the law. It's the kind of thing where you draw a line in the sand, and you tell someone that they can't cross that line. And so that person comes right up to the line. They put their toes a hair's breadth away from the line, and they stand there. They're not crossing the line. They're coming right up to it. And I know with my kids, sometimes when they're fighting, they're driving each other crazy, and I ask them to separate. And for them, this means to move a foot apart on the couch. They have the whole house, but they stay a foot apart on the couch. Or I tell them to go up the stairs. I tell them to go upstairs for some reason, and they go to the top of the stairs, and they sit at the top of the stairs, and they wait for me to tell them to go all the way to their room. Now, I don't want to single them out, because this is something we all do. This is something that we are all tempted to do, where a line is drawn, and we want to stand, for some reason, right at the line. And why do we do that? It's human nature. It's something that's in us. And that is what Jesus is talking about here. I don't know what it was like back then, but based on my own experience of lust and sexual desire, I'm guessing that there were a lot of men who were not committing adultery, who were upholding the letter of the law, but inside their hearts, they were full of adultery and lust. They were reveling in thoughts they would never, ever want anyone else to know, but because they were following the letter of the law, they felt like they were in the right. They felt justified in their lust that flourished inside of them. But Jesus tells them, no, when you do this, when you look at a woman with lust, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. So don't look at a woman with lust in your heart. This is putting you in the same danger as actual adultery, so don't do it. Don't look at a woman with lust in your heart. If your right eye was caught putting you at risk of death, you would gouge it out. And if your right hand was putting you at risk of death, you would cut it off. So if looking at a woman with lust in your heart is putting you at risk of death, then cut it out. Stop it. Don't do it. We know intuitively that gouging out the eye or cutting off your hand is not going to save you from lust. Lust is in the heart. You need to cut off what is causing you to sin, and what is causing the sin is looking with lust in this situation. And I think the point here is that cutting that out is a lot easier than cutting off a hand or gouging out an eye. So we should be more than willing to take that step. And this applies to so many things. We need to be ready to recognize what is causing our sin. What is causing the sin may not necessarily be something that violates the law or that other people would consider wrong, but if that is something that is causing us to sin, cut it out. Why put ourselves at that risk? The obvious application of this in our current context is pornography. An entire multi-billion dollar industry has been built on this tendency of primarily men to look at other humans with lust in their heart. It is such a pleasurable thing that it can become as potent as a drug. When Jesus talks of being in danger of going into hell, I know for myself very well what he means, because the potency of this feeling, this is lust, I know it very well. As a young man who was interested in looking at women with lust in his heart, there is ample material to be found. And in this digital age, it is incredibly easy to get it at the click of a button in a matter of seconds. When I first went looking for it, there was no internet. But I found it on movies showing late at night on TV. I found it on things that weren't even considered pornography by definition. Books at the library, fashion magazines, whatever it was. I was on the lookout, and they were there. I was very creative in trying to find these things. And even if I had to look really hard, I was willing to go to those lengths because it was exciting to me. And of course, then the internet came and everything has changed. And there was so much more I wanted to talk about on this morning, but I don't have time. But I just want to say quickly, I think sometimes we think of lust and pornography as a personal sin. But we see in our culture how lust has become normalized in a lot of ways. Pornography is becoming more and more accepted. It's still taboo, but it is becoming more and more. There are things that are moving. And people are starting to wake up and they're starting to see that this is not good for us. And the Me Too movement, these stories of men in power who have been abusing women for years, Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinberg, appalling stuff. This is not happening to everyone. But when we normalize lust, these things happen more and more. There was an article I saw linked to in Teen Vogue about this journalist who went to the Coachella Music Festival in California, and she wanted to go and talk to people who were at the festival about sexual harassment. She was there for 22 hours. No, she was there for 10 hours, and she was groped 22 times. This is something. The bar has moved. Things are changing in people's minds that are making, what are these men thinking? But it's becoming okay. And so this is not just about personal morality or personal responsibility. There's something happening in our culture with the norm being moving, and it is affecting more than just me or other people. And this is why this is so important. This is why this is so vital. There's a phenomenon where people throw themselves into these kinds of things that bring great pleasure, and not just pornography, but like alcohol and drugs. And often this is done to escape pain. This is done to medicate. It's done because things in their life are overwhelming. But I also believe from my own experience with something like pornography, it's possible that the discovery of these intense feelings and sensations, they can ensnare us even when we don't really have something to escape. They can be so pleasurable. They can push buttons inside of us that we're in danger, not just because we feel like we need to escape something, but just because they're so potent. And I know that for me, I was curious. I went down that road, and I found myself on a road that I didn't want to be on, but it was really hard to get off. And pornography is different from drugs and alcohol in the way that it doesn't necessarily do physical damage to the body. It's not going to fry your liver or your brain. You can't overdose on pornography. The danger of that kind of physical harm is a lot less with pornography. But it does change the brain. It changes the way you think. It takes hold of your thought processes, and it's not a healthy thing. There's many cases of young men who've become hooked on pornography, and they just can't relate to real people. They They just want to sit in the rooms and look in pornography. It has impacts. And it's remarkable how more and more people are starting to realize, people who have no reason from a moral perspective to oppose pornography, but they're starting to see how it is affecting us, and they're thinking, hold on, what have we done? And this is why Jesus' words are so relevant and so vital for our cultural context 2,000 years later. So in order to avoid the risk, in order to cut out the danger, we don't want to go right up to the line. We want to go far from the line. We want to cut out the things that cause the sin. And in some cases, you know, maybe we want to, if that is a danger, you know, maybe it's a matter of cutting off the internet or, you know, spending more time with people. There are things that if something is a pain, a struggle for you, you need to figure out what you need to cut out. What does it mean to stop looking at a woman with lust in your eyes, in your heart? And as I said before, it can be applied to so many things. What do we need to cut out to prevent ourselves from falling over that line? And I like the illustration of the man who keeps falling into a hole whenever he walks down a certain street. He goes down the street, and every time he goes down the street, he falls into a hole. What is he going to do? He keeps going down the street, and he keeps falling down the hole. Go down a different street. That is the answer. And this is such simple advice, but in some ways it's so hard, because I think we like going up to the line. We like to test the boundaries of danger. And I think this also embodies one of the most important principles that we can draw from the Sermon on the Mount. There's a striking phrase later on that Jesus uses in the sermon, and he tells his disciples to be perfect as God is perfect. He says this in the context of loving our enemies, but I find it so amazing that he actually tells his disciples to be perfect. Look it up. He actually says it. Be perfect as God is perfect. Everybody knows that we can't be perfect. Trying to be perfect is a recipe for burning yourself out, for disappointment. But Jesus doesn't shy away from saying this. Jesus is not drawing a new line in the sand for his disciples to stand next to. You know, it seems sometimes that if the line for adultery is here, it seems like, okay, well, Jesus is drawing a line here. But actually, I think Jesus is saying, no, be perfect. Okay, there's a line here and there's a line there, but perfect, that's over there. That's where we're going. He's not drawing a new line. In some ways, he is. In some ways, if you can move from that line to that line, that's a good thing. But Jesus is saying, no, perfection is over there, and that is where we're going. And it's, I mean, to be perfect, that's crazy. Like, we can't be perfect. But Jesus says that. And so I think there's something really important to draw from this. Obviously, Jesus is saying it. But so Jesus is setting this ideal, and he's telling people to be perfect. And why this works, it becomes clear when we see how Jesus treats people. Jesus talks about perfection, and he calls his disciples to pursue the ideal. But when they fail, he treats them with grace and with mercy. He loves them through their failure, and he guides them through their struggles. When he tells them to be perfect, he's not expecting them to be perfect right away. It's not an oppressive thing. It's about looking up and out rather than looking down at the line in the sand. If we look to God and to perfection, we might have a chance of actually making some progress in that direction. And we can make that effort with confidence, knowing that God will receive our failures and our shortcomings with grace. And so with that in mind, I want to move to the next passage. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Oh my goodness, time is flying. You know what? I think I should set aside divorce. I have a lot of time left. What I wanted to say, I'm going to summarize, I'm going to go off notes and say this quickly because it is short of time. I want to respect that. The thing with divorce, I was actually struggling with this last night. I fell into the trap of feeling like I need to make a pronouncement on whether divorce is right or wrong. Oh my gosh, and I know that I'm not qualified. Like, of course I'm not qualified. And I think that what I felt like I needed to bring was that Jesus says that the ideal is not to divorce. God's ideal for marriage, and Jesus says it later on in Matthew, he says that God's intention was not for people. When a man and a woman come together in marriage, he says, it's not for them to separate. What God has brought together, let man not separate. And so he sets up that ideal. He says, this is the ideal. And he's not saying, you have to be that. As he says with being perfect, he's saying that's where we want to be. But when people fail, God is there with grace and with mercy, and he redeems. And we know that. I'm sure we all know people who have gone through that, that very painful thing. And so I wanted to set up that idea of the perfection versus how God treats us with grace and mercy. I think that is the perfect lens to look at pornography, divorce. Jesus is saying, and he was also speaking to people who were, I think, were treating divorce lightly. I think they were looking for justification. What can I do to get rid of my wife? Can I do it if she burns the food? Like these conversations were actually happening. It's not like all the rabbis were saying yes, but there were people who were advocating for easy divorce. And Jesus is speaking into that and says, no, you can't do that. And he speaks very strongly about that. He's speaking to them. And this is to protect. This is to correct. He's pointing to that ideal. But we know that God also holds grace and mercy. He wants us to move to that, and not in the heaviness, not in the oppression of feeling like we have to be this certain thing. We look to God, we move in that direction, and when we fall, God picks us up. And so that's what I wanted to say about divorce. There were so many things I wanted to say. I love the Sermon on the Mount. I think that we have in here a model for living that it's just remarkable. God is so good. And so I think I'll close here, just going back quickly, just to remember that line in the sand, we love to go up to it, but God is saying, no, step away from the line, cut out the things that are causing you to sin, look to the perfection, look to the ideal, and I will help you to get there. Thank you.